From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tell Newt to Shut Up! That's a new book on the so-called Republican Revolution.
That's not me telling Newt to shut up. My mother told me it wasn't polite to tell people to shut up. It's not even Newt's Democratic enemies. It's his own best friends, people in the Republican rank and file, who felt after a full year of Newt's verbal faux pas that it was time to bench him, to get him out of the way.
And black church firebombings in the South.
So much was burned that we can't get back in memory. I hate to even think about it. Every time I think about it, tears come from my eyes. I just can't comprehend why would a person go around burning the house of God.
Congress holds its first hearings, but are the attacks being properly investigated? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a minute, we're going to be taking a look at the first year of the so-called Republican Revolution. But before we do that, we wanted to take a look at the primaries that took place yesterday in Oregon and Arkansas. And joining us to, lay them out for us and what happened is Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky from Berkeley. Hi, Larry.
Hello, Amy. These are two relatively small states, Arkansas and Oregon. Arkansas has four members of Congress in the House of Representatives and six electoral votes, and Oregon has seven with five members of Congress, two senators, and therefore seven electoral votes. And therefore, you can't really draw too much national implication from these two races and these two primaries. But we do see some things that I think are indicative of what's going on nationally. The win by Tom Bruguiere, who is a multi-millionaire entrepreneur, cyberspace entrepreneur in Oregon, of the Democratic primary rather easily, indicates that one of the Democrats' national strategies seems to be surfacing here, and that is to find candidates that are wealthy enough to fund their own races. Now, Bruguiere has said that he's not going to do that, unlike his opponent, who's the same guy who lost to Ron Wyden last time, who funded last time, Gordon Smith funded his campaign. He's another multimillionaire in Oregon. He spent over $2 million last time. This time he says he's not going to spend that type of money. So we have two extremely wealthy candidates facing off against each other for the seat of Republican Mark Hatfield, who's retiring. Another element that we see nationally that comes up in Oregon in yesterday's primary is the recruitment by Democrats of conservative Democrats who they think have a better chance to win back some seats in the House rather than their traditional liberal constituency. Listeners may remember the saga of Wes Cooley, the man who represents all of eastern Oregon. If you look at a map of Oregon, they have five congressional seats, as I said, but one of them encompasses about two-thirds of the geography of the state. It's entirely rural, and that is the one represented by Wes Cooley, a man who's been accused of misrepresenting his war record, of perhaps fudging his marriage record so that his wife could continue to get a pension of a widow, etc., touched deeply by
military
scandal.
Military widow.
Yeah, military widow. He was unopposed in the Republican primary, and he's refused to resign his seat, saying he's looking forward to campaigning in the fall.
I mean, it looks like almost everything about him is a lie. He seems like a pathological liar at things he doesn't even have to lie about, like being Phi Beta Kappa in college.
Yeah, he has a lot of problems with that, and he's going to have even more problems because his opponent is a district attorney. There are about 12 counties in that district, and westernmost of those counties, Deschutes County, the Democrat who's been selected in the primary is Mike Dugan, who's the district attorney. So it's going to be law and order versus lies there, and it's a possibility for the Democrats to pick up a seat in Oregon. One of the interesting phenomena that came up in Oregon yesterday, Amy, is something that we've remarked on before in this national race so far, and that is the relative decline of the power of the Christian Coalition. People may remember the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which sponsored local and statewide anti-gay initiatives in Oregon. Well, the man who was behind that, Lon Mabon, decided that Gordon Smith, the Republican multimillionaire who lost to Ron Wyden in the Senate runoff a few months ago, that Lon Mabon decided Gordon Smith was too liberal for him and that he, Mabon, would enter the primary himself in the Republican primary yesterday. Mabon got only 8% of the vote, approximately. And that is something of a tip-off, I think, as to the relative decline of the power of the Christian Coalition and the desire of the Christian Coalition, as we've seen with Ralph Reed backing Bob Dole, to play coalition politics rather than go out there on their own.
And a new name from Oregon will be in the House starting now, I guess, and that's Earl Blumenau, a Portland City Commissioner, who is filling Ron Wyden's seat, which will also give him an edge in November.
Yes, Blumenauer will fill Ron Wyden's seat and is not expected to have any trouble there. Quickly looking at the state of Arkansas, the Republicans there are kind of licking their lips in glee, thinking that they'll pick up the first Republican Senate seat in history from Arkansas if Lieutenant Governor Mike Huckabee can win that seat in November. However, Attorney General Winston Bryant led the pack yesterday for the Democrats. He's going to face a runoff, but he finished very strongly ahead of the second-place finisher. The runoff will be June 11th. It's not by any means certain that the Republicans are going to be able to win there, especially since right now President Clinton looks like he's going to take his home state handsomely and may have some long coattails. So there again, as in Oregon, these are two key seats in the Senate. The Democrats need, of course, to win the one from the Republicans in Oregon and hold the one their own in Arkansas.
Larry?
And they made some steps yesterday towards doing that.
Thank you very much for that quick wrap-up. Larry Venske out in Berkeley, our national affairs correspondent. Well, after success with the Contract with America, the Republican majority in the House of Representatives lost momentum by the end of 95, in part because the controversial rhetoric and personal foibles of Speaker Newt Gingrich. We now turn to Michael Weitzkopf of the Washington Post, who's co-author of a new book based on a Pulitzer Prize-nominated series of articles that went behind the scenes into the so-called Republican Revolution. Michael Weitzkopf, why don't you tell us about your book, Tell Newt to Shut Up?
Well, it's a fly-on-the-wall look at the first year of Republican control of the House of Representatives in 40 years, and a look at sort of following closely the leader of that Republican Revolution, Newt Gingrich. The book itself is called Tell Newt to Shut Up, and that's not me telling Newt to shut up. My mother told me it wasn't polite to tell people to shut up. It's not even Newt's Democratic enemies. It's his own best friends, people in the Republican rank and file, who felt after a full year of Newt's verbal faux pas that it was time to bench him, to get him out of the way. And what really prompted this more than anything else was his infamous return from his trip to Israel to Rabin's funeral on Air Force One, when he complained bitterly and openly that Clinton wouldn't talk to him on the plane and made him go off the back of the plane. And this explained in part for the rigid kind of hardline Republican stand on the budget and on government shutdowns.
Why did that happen?
It, well, Gingrich, for all his brilliance of vision and ability to articulate it, often gets tired and kind of loses perspective. He goes often too far and doesn't measure his words and understand enough of their impact. It was something that his closest allies recognized from the start. On the day the Republicans took over in January of 95, when Newt was marching around from interview to interview as kind of an overstuffed general, he ran into a freshman congressman from California by the name of Sonny Bono. You'll all remember of Sonny and Cher days. And Sonny took him aside and said, you know, Newt, the world has changed for you. You're not anymore a politician. You're a celebrity. Sonny said, I'm a celebrity. I used to be a bigger one, and I know all about what it's like to be a celebrity. You've got to watch what you say. You have to have handlers. You have to realize the impact of your own language will surprise you at sometimes. And Newt kind of shrugged it off as the kind of innocence of a freshman congressman and went about his schedule. A year later, in an interview with us, he conceded it was a lesson he should have learned.
You open your book in a dramatic way with Newt Gingrich dissolving into tears.
He was sobbing like a baby, and there was an initial kind of prompting of that. He had just heard from the chairman of the Ethics Committee that all but a single charge lodged by Democrats had been waved away by the Ethics Committee, and he was actually in a meeting of farm state legislators trying to work on dairy price supports. In came Mary Ann Gingrich's wife and said to Newt, who had not passed on the content of his conversation on ethics earlier, Mary Ann said, "I understand you've got some information about our lives." And Gingrich paused and said, "Yeah, I just heard from the ethics people. They've waved it all away." And one of the congressmen in the room said, "You know, Newt, that sounds like a great victory." And Gingrich began misting up and said, "Yeah, that's true, but you don't know the effect this has had on my wife and my children with charge after charge after charge for 3 years. And at that point, he began breaking up and sobbing uncontrollably. Mary Ann Gingrich came over and hugged him, as did one of the congressmen. Later, he explained to us that it was more than just a cathartic release from the waving away of those charges. He was sobbing under the weight of the full year, the struggles of pushing his revolution and its contract with America through the Democratic Democratic opposition in the Congress, and most importantly, the frustrations of dealing with President Clinton over the centerpiece of the Republican agenda, the balanced budget.
But it's not just the Democrats he had to push his Republican revolution through. It's also the Republicans, especially the old guard Republicans. In fact, isn't it true that many of the old guard, the committee leaders like Henry Hyde, for example, head of the House Judiciary Committee, really hate his guts?
I don't think that's a fair statement. I think they're concerned that Gingrich gives the impression of extremism, and almost as much in his kind of verbal pronouncements as he does in his policies. And he has to measure his words. They also recognize, though, that he is the only one with the kind of strength of vision and the ability to mobilize the full rank and file of the Republican Party to keep it as a united bloc.
But isn't he setting up a kind of parallel structure to kind of circumvent the power of the committee chairs, afraid that they will not follow through on the Republican revolution?
Well, all power flows from the top, in this case, as any other organization. And he controlled the appointment of committee chairs, and on, for instance, the Appropriations Committee, one of the most important and powerful of committees. He elevated one of his allies, Bob Livingston, over three members with greater tenure and standing. And through that, Livingston, of course, was able to handpick his subcommittee chairman, known as the Cardinals. And they were told pretty much from the start that the way things were going to be done was through the Gingrich agenda, and if they were not happy, they could step aside. Each of them was asked to kind of commit to loyalty in writing to Gingrich.
Let's go back in time a little before the Republicans took over Congress. And can you talk about that core group that Newt Gingrich organized, including the exterminator from Texas?
Sure. Years before the Republicans took over in 95 and won the election in 94, Gingrich had the dream and vision of compiling a Republican majority with him at the top. And as a young, mutton-chopped congressman from Georgia, convinced the Republican Party to allow him to become the head of strategic planning. There's an old joke that there was a long line of file cabinets at the Republican National Committee called Newt Ideas, and at the end of the long line was one file cabinet with the label Newt's Good Ideas. He was a man who was very good at planning and understood the flow of power, and decided early on he had to pull together a handful of Republican figures who were close to him philosophically and had the power to run big organizations. One of them, you mentioned a minute ago, was Tom DeLay, a former pest exterminator from Houston, who became a central figure later on as Republican whip. And in power, delay became the sort of symbol and spokesman for the anti-regulatory drive of Republicans' efforts to roll back environmental and workplace regulations. One of our favorite scenes in the book comes kind of early, about a day before the Republicans were sworn in, when DeLay invited into his new Capitol office amid packing boxes and dysfunctional Xerox machines a small handful of corporate lobbyists, and these were people known to him over the years, and he gave them a mission to draft legislation freezing regulations of their own industries and others while the Republican Congress had time to work on new methodology for permanent regulations. And this group of corporate lobbyists ended up not only drafting a bill for him, but lining up co-sponsors and drafting amendments, and even when the bill was on the floor of the House, running a war room right off the floor in which lobbyists would be spinning out talking points from laptop computers to be taken to Republican members of the floor who are trying to counter Democratic arguments.
Do you think that the media covered this in as an extensive a way as it deserves, the fact that lobbyists were writing legislation and really running the show?
David and I spent all of 95 and the beginning of 96 covering it in an in-depth way in the Washington Post the machinations of Republicans and the lobbying community. And it must be said at this point that while corporate lobbyists were extremely influential in this Congress, the Democrats in their days had their own friends and allies among lobbyists, just a different crowd. There were trial lawyers and labor lobbyists and members of public interest groups. So you can't look at Republicans as a whole new species. They just tilted government in the direction of their own attendance of power.
Like Tom DeLay, the hammer.
Yes, that's a description he was given for his related role in fundraising. It was DeLay's job to make sure that money flowed along the same stream as policy, a role he cultivated in such an unforgiving way he became known as the hammer. And another nice scene in the book is DeLay inviting unsuspecting lobbyists into his office. And they would find him head down looking at a list of the 400 largest contributors across the board. And this was a list that showed how much was given by each corporate entity and what percentage to Republicans. And as a lobbyist stood in front of his desk, the hammer would be looking down at the list and saying, "See, you're in there." And the lobbyist could only imagine how far he had come to please or displease Tom DeLay. And by the time he left, he knew full well what it would take to stay on the hammer's good side. Many of them did. For years, corporate lobbyists supported Democrats financially. At best, they played a kind of defensive role in return. They get called in as after legislation was written to give comments. But now they were the full partners in shaping congressional priorities, and they took with one hand and gave with another. In an extraordinary collection, the Republicans and their campaign committee picked up $100 million in their first year in power, more than twice the Democratic take. And even more startling was the reversal in historic patterns of giving by political action committees. In the last cycle of Congress, in the 92 election, PACs gave two-thirds of their money to Democrats. In the first year in power, the Republicans ended up reversing that, receiving 61% of PAC money, in part because of the work of the hammer.
We're talking to Michael Weisskopf, and he is co-author with David Marinus of Tell Newt to Shut Up. We're also featuring at this hour The Foreman. I thought it was a good time to bring you the privateers of the public airwaves.
We're privateers of the public airwaves.
Beware ye public broadcasters.
We're coming for to scuttle your scurvy membership.
will be about as subtle as a sloop upon a slip. There ain't no damn rebuttal, what'll button up our lip? Prepare to take a dip.
We're ravaging your culture,
we're pillaging ad hoc. Don't bother to consult
your stars
or talk your dandy talk.
For yonder be a vulture circling with a budget hawk.
So down the blanky.
What? Audio ho ho, video ho ho. You're sinking fast, you'll never last. So stand up, ask ye knaves.
We're privateers,
privateers of the public airwaves.
Privateers of the public airwaves. The Four Men are bringing that to you. You're listening to Democracy Now! In the last segment of the show, we're going to be talking about the firebombings of black churches. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Michael Weitzkopf in a continuing conversation about his new book, Tell Newt to Shut Up. He's written it with his colleague at The Washington Post, David Marinus. Michael's been there for the past 18 years. He's on the national staff of the Post covering Congress and lobbying. From 1980 to 1985, he was the Post correspondent in China. He lives now in Washington, D.C. We just heard the Four Men singing about the privateers of the public airwaves. Michael, why was Newt Gingrich so obsessed with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
In his mind represented values shaped by his political enemies. It was use of public monies to kind of advance ideas which didn't fit into his own agenda. But more importantly, it was a kind of megaphone for his political enemies, he felt, and one that didn't deserve taxpayer funds.
Let's talk a little more about those people that he surrounds himself with. We talked about Tom DeLay, the hammer, the exterminator from Texas. What about Dick Armey, the majority leader in the House?
Armey represents the philosophical right of the party, and in an unbending kind of way. And for many of the of Newt's followers, is a greater emblem or kind of standard for the way things should be done. And Armey's role is to really kind of run things for Gingrich. He considers himself the chief operating officer, to Gingrich as chief executive officer. He also, though, is capable of drawing together conservatives in a more coherent fashion than Gingrich is, who, interestingly, is not considered by many of his closest allies to be a true conservative. They see him as a pragmatist, an activist, a guy who knows how to attain power and how to wield it, but a guy who won't always deliver on conservative principles.
Is it true that right now Newt Gingrich is facing a kind of mutiny, that you have Tom DeLay, for example, I hear, who is leaking things about Newt Gingrich, possibly things that are being considered in the Ethics Committee, that you've got Dick Armey possibly forming an alliance with Tom DeLay, this as, you know, Dole moves forward and some say he had to leave the Senate because he had to shake Newt Gingrich off of him?
Gingrich is the head of a corporation also led by ambitious vice presidents. You've named a couple of them. I think they all recognize that he is the howitzer, as they call him. He's the guy who they will pull out to achieve the more difficult tasks, a guy who can hold them together more than anyone else. The Republican Party is a big tent, just like the Democrats. It's got conservatives and ultra-conservatives and a sprinkling of moderates. All of them are required to work and march in step if they want to pass their agenda. And only Gingrich can rally them, as we showed. In one particular chapter, we talk about how Gingrich marched his troops through their most difficult campaign, the passage of spending bills that cut into social services deeper than any others. In that bill, there were kind of hinge issues such as abortion. And abortion is an issue which draws more than any other, draws out the splits within the party more than any other. And the way he handled it earned him respect as a conciliator. In one room he had Republican moderates, many of them from the Northeast, who were concerned about the label of extremism if Republicans shut off all federal funding to abortions. In another room were about 30 ultra-conservatives, those who are adamantly anti-abortion, and they were holding a prayer session, holding hands and singing hymns and discussing the temptations of power and how important it is not to give in and not to turn their backs on their own constituency, right-to-life constituency. Gingrich walked into a real lion's den there. He ended up coming out with a compromise that made everyone happy. And really, as much as anything, identified his role as an important bridge builder in the party.
We're talking to Michael Weisskopf. He is the co-author of a new book just out, Tell Newt to Shut Up. He wrote it with his colleague at The Washington Post, David Marinus. Now, let me ask you about the whole scandal over the book advance, the $4.5 million book advance that Newt Gingrich was promised by HarperCollins, ultimately by Rupert Murdoch. Now, he brought down the earlier House Speaker, Jim Wright, over a similar, well, at least an arrangement around a book deal. How stupid is Newt Gingrich? I mean, people say he's smart.
I think he had difficulty measuring the impact of this from the start also. It goes back to our earlier discussion about his use of language and how often he misuses it and misplays his hand. That was an earlier case of kind of concern to his own leadership. And when he got this big offer from HarperCollins, headed by Robert Murdoch, a guy who has plenty of business in front of his Congress, I think he saw it, one, as an opportunity to kind of espouse his views for a larger audience, and in that fashion, kind of following through on party objectives. But early on, he started getting concerns raised by his own leadership, who said it looked like he was cashing in and it was distracting from the Republican agenda. And that more than anything else made him back off. Mm-hmm. It was about the same time he began talking about how the White House was infested by drug users and how orphanages were kind of a solution for the nation's welfare problems. He really sort of started off on the wrong footing, and it was even then people were not maybe using this term, but really wanted him to shut up.
You talked earlier about the ethics complaints against him and how most of them were dropped. In fact, Nancy Johnson, who is head of the Ethics Committee, a Republican from Connecticut who's facing a tough battle in her own district, may well, because of that tough battle, and that she doesn't want to be seen as just towing the line for Newt Gingrich, it is possible that even with most of those complaints dropped, that something serious can be brought against Newt Gingrich. How possible do you think that is?
I think very difficult. These are really kind of historical charges. They were lodged by political enemies in the Democratic Party. Nancy Johnson heads a committee that's tipped in favor of Republicans, but also has Democratic members on them. If if they felt that it was loaded in Gingrich's favor, you would have heard more from them. I think that they were put in the proper perspective, and that what he faces is much more serious in a way, and that is rebellion, not only from his own rank and file, but from voters in this coming election. This will be a real mandate on his reign, and the Democrats realize that, and as often as they possibly can, link Dole with Gingrich.
And what do you think is the possibility of, well, two things. One, Gingrich being defeated in his own district in Georgia, facing maybe some possibly serious competition from a millionaire cookie maker. And number two, even if he wins, being deposed as Speaker of the House.
I think in the latter case, it's very unlikely. He is the father of the Republican Revolution. He led them from the mountaintop into the promised land. He still is the only guy with the ability to control what can be an unruly conference of his peers. And if Dole wins, particularly, I think that this will be an opportunity for Gingrich to redeem himself in the public eye. As far as his own election goes, while he faces a formidable opponent in redistricting the district outside of Atlanta is heavily weighted in favor of conservatives and Republicans. So he's in pretty good shape that way.
Michael Weitzkopf, what about the kind of hate-mongering that's been going on in Congress? I'll give two examples. One, you've got Dick Armey calling Barney Frank Barney Fag and then going to the floor of the House and castigating reporters for reporting this. But, of course, that message goes out, and it sort of sets a climate that allows for that use of that kind of word. And then you've got Newt Gingrich, and one of the first things that he faced was his mother saying that he'd called Hillary Clinton a bitch. And his mother repeated this to many reporters, so it seemed almost as if he had kind of told her this was okay, and that certainly sends out a message to professional women, to working women, what he thinks of them, I think, more than the First Lady. What was your take on all of that?
It really reflected the promiscuous kind of use of language these kind of new holders of power practiced. And you have to remember that for 40 years, Republicans were far outside of the centers of power. And even for the 15 years prior to that, in which Gingrich and Armey played a role, they weren't used to having cameras following them around all over and having microphones put in their faces and having their words measured closely.
Well, you know, when I came down to Washington last year in the first 100 days of Congress and asked Gingrich about that before he ended Speaker's Conference, asked him about his calling Hillary Clinton a bitch, he got absolutely furious. In fact, the UPI reporter who'd covered him from the first day and been to every Speaker's Conference said he never saw him so out of control, that I had sort of asked him something outside of the agenda or what was considered acceptable in Speaker's Conference.
He has a hard time measuring, a hard time kind of dealing with questions outside of his own sense of propriety. And I think going back to the Sonny Bono remark, he didn't realize the extent to which the public and the media were sort of peering into the character and the life of this important political leader.
Let me ask you one last question about the budget. You talked about budget balancing. John Kasich plays a role in your book. What is his relationship with Newt Gingrich?
He's a protege of Gingrich's, and they have quite different styles. Kasich is a rambunctious, spontaneous figure from the nation's heartland, Columbus, Ohio, and he wears the nation's heartland on his sleeve. He is most committed to balancing the budget. It is a kind of religious fervor with him. He is kind of unpractical sometimes about how he approaches those objectives. Gingrich is most of all a pragmatist, often has to rein in Kasich. But Kasich understands that Newt is an engine he can hook on to and carry him pretty far. And the two of them worked very closely and very successfully. At the end, he served for us throughout the year as a kind of touchstone for the revolution. The extent to which John Kasich's objectives were being met would for us be a kind of measure of how much the Republicans were achieving the public mandate they had set out back in 94. And Kasich got very frustrated with Gingrich during the budget period. He talked about, told us about how when Gingrich would come out of the sessions with Clinton, sessions where he was often cowed or conned, if Kasich had his way of putting it. He'd say, sometimes I'd want to flash a flashlight in Newt's eyes to make sure he was all there, and felt that he was too compliant, that he was looking too hard for a deal with Clinton, a guy with whom no deal was possible.
Do you think it's possible John Kasich could be Dole's running mate?
He brings a lot to the ticket. He is a born-again Christian and kind of will solidify for Dole that constituency. He also translates very well with younger voters. He is, as I said, a real live spirit on the campaign trail. He's sort of a bottle rocket who just spurts in all directions. He is young. He comes from a district instead of, and he doesn't run statewide, so he is of limited recognition. Although Republicans, probably as early as October of last year, began trotting him out as a spokesman. They feel that he carries very, very well and is carrying the message today.
Let's end with the relationship between Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole. Do you think overall he is a liability for Bob Dole? And do you think Newt Gingrich is going to self-destruct?
It's a complex relationship. Years ago, Gingrich used to speak of Dole with disdain as the tax collector of the welfare state, a kind of representative of elite country club Republicanisms people who had played too long with Democrats. I think he gained a kind of grudging at first respect for Dole in dealing close with him during the budget talks. Realized that Dole has something he doesn't have, which is a sort of steadfastness and a high principle and a consistency. And at the end of those budget talks, kind of emerged in his own words as a junior partner to Dole. And the two of them are really inextricably linked because Gingrich, in order to redeem himself and regain credibility with the larger public and to some extent with the ranks of Republicans, has got to help Dole win. He's got to at least make a good showing. And in that sense, connecting himself to Dole can be therapeutic. Dole needs Gingrich also because for all of his strengths, he lacks vision and the ability to articulate, to speak well, and come up with compelling messages. No one is better in the Republican Party than Newt. Will he self-destruct? I think not. I think that he set out from a very early age to be exactly what he is, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. He loves the job. I think he'll find ways of avoiding sort of some of the mistakes he's made over the past year. And we'll regain an important voice in politics today.
Michael Weitzkopf, in your journey covering the Republican Revolution, what has most surprised you?
I think the extent to which they misread Clinton, and we saw that at the end in the budget debacle of December and January. They saw Clinton as a vacillator, an expedient guy who would do anything for a deal, and a guy who would abandon his own principles to get there. They didn't understand how Clinton, who, to remind you, was in the position of having to declare himself relevant at the beginning of the revolution back in January of 95, they didn't understand the extent to which he could redefine himself in opposition to Republicans and how they ended up handing Clinton his own campaign platform by trying to roll back environmental regulations and cutting education spending and going after programs, entitlement programs like Medicaid and Medicare. Those are four high principles in Clinton's reelection drive. The Republicans gave it to him and allowed him to really kind of redefine himself. And in the process, they ended up hurting themselves. And Gingrich himself was used to say he melted like ice cream around Clinton. His own staff had to watch him closely not to concede too much. Dick Armey was asked to join budget talks along with Gingrich to sort of keep him in line. And the two of them are baby boomers, both from semi-dysfunctional homes, both loved to drive Mustangs and had a love for policy. Here they were in the historic rooms of the White House trying to do something no Congress had done for over 30 years, and that was to balance its books. And the problem was that Clinton had something Gingrich didn't, and that was a charm and an ability to get his way with language. And he succeeded.
Michael Weisskopf, thanks for joining us. Michael Weisskopf and David Marinus have written the new book, Tell Newt to Shut Up. And we'll be back in just a minute. Coming up, attacks on black churches in the South. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Since 1990, 45 African-American churches in the South have been burned to the ground. But most of those fires have happened in the past year and a half. At a House Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday, federal officials said so far they haven't found any evidence of a conspiracy behind the series of arson attacks. But some at the hearing questioned the Clinton administration's commitment to the investigation. Pacifica's Don Rush was there, and he brings us this report.
Since 1995, one federal government agency has been investigating 25 arsons that have occurred at predominantly black churches in the Southeast. For the Reverend Algie Jarrett, fire struck his Tennessee church in January of 1995 and burned it to the ground.
So much was burned that we can't get back in memory. I hate to even think about it. Every time I think about it, tears come from my eyes. I just can't comprehend why would a person go around burning the house of God.
And there was the Reverend Terrence Mackey. His church went up in flames 6 months later.
Whatever it takes, I think, whatever means it takes to bring these perpetrators to justice need to be done. Because we look at the fact that they're tearing the very fiber of our country. Whether we go to church on Sundays or stay home on Sundays.
And Deval Patrick, head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, has characterized the recent fires as an epidemic of terror. But the Clinton administration has come under fire from civil rights groups for not pursuing the fires with enough intensity. During a hearing by the House Judiciary Committee, Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee pointed to the federal response to the Freeman standoff in Montana.
The resources are not there. We've got 100 people in Montana only because of Waco, Ruby Ridge, and the tragedy, I imagine, of Oklahoma City. But we have a tragedy burning here. There needs to be more resources directed toward this effort.
Deval Patrick with the Justice Department fended off such criticism, saying the administration was taking these fires seriously.
This is not a lightly taken investigation. 200-plus federal investigators committed full-time to these active investigations is not a light commitment of resources. But there is no question we could do more with more. And what I can suggest to you and to others on the committee is that we'll pull together our list as promptly as possible and come up and go from there.
And Committee Chair Henry Hyde of Illinois said Congress would approve additional authority for law enforcement agencies if necessary. Under questioning, law enforcement officials said they had been working with local communities to expedite the investigations. But the National Council of Churches of Christ USA says such interest has only come recently. And the Reverend Dr. Mac Charles Jones with the council notes the investigations have been anything but friendly.
In one congregation, Sweet Home Baptist Church, they talked about, in fact, every single member was told that they were suspects. We talked to pastors who talked about having been asked to take polygraph tests. Members asked to take polygraph tests. Folk told that if your children were involved in anything illegal, they too would be suspect. 17-year-old girl in Tennessee pulled out of her classroom, taken downtown, interrogated by law enforcement officials about her pastor.
And the council dismisses the assertion by federal officials that there is no evidence of a conspiracy. The council points to similarities in the fires, including a number of them occurring around Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. The council, by the way, was not allowed to testify before the committee. Federal law enforcement officials have not had a very good track record for many in the black community. Even in recent years, there have been problems with discrimination. And California Democrat Maxine Waters said federal officials don't have to look any further than the racist acts at the now infamous Good Ol' Boys Roundup.
We understand what ATF was all about when you had numbers represented at that picnic, and we know what your numbers are. And we know that the lack of representation of people of color in the ATF does not speak well to your ability to diversify in ways that would make us comfortable.
And Michigan Democrat John Conyers suggested there was an atmosphere that encouraged these kinds of fires.
Maybe we should lower this rhetoric of political opportunism that allows everybody to play the race game at their heart's content until somebody drops a match. Oh, then that's awful. You cross the line.
Perhaps the most eloquent statement of the day came from the Reverend Algie Jarrett, whose Tennessee church was destroyed by fire last year.
I want to close by saying, even though somebody burned it, I guess, I don't know, I'm not a law enforcement, this is a law job, I'm a preacher of the gospel. But even though if somebody burn it, they still in our prayer, because we can't go around hating folks. And I thank God for his things that being as well as it is.
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Thanks, Don. Also testifying at yesterday's hearing was an African-American representative of the Christian Coalition, the political arm of millionaire television preacher Pat Robertson. The overwhelmingly white movement has been trying to reach out to people of color. Reverend Earl Jackson Sr. is the national liaison for urban development of the Christian Coalition.
Now, let me make clear the interest of the Christian Coalition. To paraphrase Dr. King, an attack on Christianity anywhere is an attack on Christianity everywhere. It is our mission to be sure that Christian values, ideals, and institutions foundational to our country's history remain the building blocks of our present and future. We are not the white Christian Coalition, or the Black Christian Coalition, or the Protestant or Catholic Christian Coalition. We are the Christian Coalition, and our brothers and sisters are white and black and brown and yellow and red and of all denominations, and we intend to stand with them. The executive director of the Christian Coalition, Dr. Ralph Reed, has left no room for misunderstanding our position. He has said that, and I quote, "The terrorists who committed these crimes against our African American brothers and sisters will be dealt with. We will hunt them down. We will bring them to justice and put them away for a long, long time." In addition to the $25,000 reward we've offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of perpetrators, we're mobilizing Christian Coalition leaders across the country to support these churches in whatever way we can. We will not rest, and trust this committee will not either, until the executive branch of the government and its federal law enforcement agencies do their most fundamental duty inspired by the very birth of this nation, protect the First Amendment right of citizens to worship their God.
And that was the Reverend Earl Jackson, Sr. of the Christian Coalition. Joining us now from California is Pacifica reporter Dennis Bernstein. He's recently back from the South, where he's been investigating the church burnings for a radio documentary he'll be airing on Democracy Now! In the coming months. Dennis, I think it's interesting to hear the Christian Coalition testify, and yet the Center for Democratic Renewal, based in Atlanta, was not invited, and they have been some of the leaders in investigating these church burnings.
Of course, the center there has been reporting on this, Amy Goodman, for some time, and the Christian Coalition wouldn't even have the slightest idea that any churches were burning if it was not for their reports and their forcing the story out into the mainstream. As far as the Christian Coalition's commitment to this story, they're Johnny-come-lately. According to some of the people that Ron Nixon and myself, I've been traveling through the South with Ron Nixon of Southern Exposure magazine, they're not impressed. The Christian Coalition so far has offered a $25,000 reward upon capture and conviction of somebody who burned a church somewhere. They have not been down there to date rebuilding churches. They have not come up with the big bucks, the millions that Ralph Reed can raise when he's supporting his causes, anti-abortion, so on and so forth, to rebuild the churches. They're not standing side by side with the coalition. Plus the fact that it's the Christian Coalition and other right-wing organizations that have given birth to not just a church-burning movement, but setting the tone top to bottom. It doesn't matter if the Attorney General of Alabama, the next sort of Jesse Helms senator, talks to the Klanners. They've set a tone across the South. They've seized this moment to turn back the clock on the civil rights movement. It's not just attacks on churches, and the Christian Coalition knows. It's shooting and destroying, defaming, defacing civil rights monuments like the grave of Jimmie Lee Jackson in Alabama, or shooting into the monument for the three civil rights workers that were killed in Jackson, Mississippi. It's the opening fire in Jackson, Mississippi of Larry Shoemakes, who is shooting at white people. No investigation. They say not racially motivated. And this is happening across the South.
Dennis,
yes.
You're talking about the Attorney General of Alabama, who clearly is involved in the investigation here of the church burnings. I thought it would be interesting to go to an interview that you and Ron Nixon of Southern Exposure magazine did when you were down South just a few weeks ago with Rose Sanders of the Voting Rights Museum, where she specifically talks about this Attorney General and why she has lost faith in the investigation.
When I heard of the church burnings first outside of Selma and then in Selma, it became clear to me that we are again at war. We are again at war. And the problem is that the victims don't even understand it or believe it. So one by one, we're being cut down in our schools, on the streets, and now in our churches. And I guess that was my reaction. Now our churches. It's not enough to kill our children. It's not enough to kill us in our schools where our children are tracked and receive a vicious, separate and unequal education which drive them to the streets. After all this oppression and humiliation now, the last straw is to attack the foundation of our belief system, our churches.
Rose Sanders, it has been suggested that this is a two-pronged attack on the black community, top-down, bottom-up. From the top-down, you've got the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who appears not to be particularly moved, on the one hand, about investigating the burning of the churches. On the other hand, he is conducting a major investigation into voter fraud, particularly relating to black officials. Could you talk a little bit about what's going on there and how perhaps the attitude at the top sets the atmospheric pressure for what's happening at the grassroots level?
Yes, I think that's a very powerful point. Jeff Sessions has always been an enemy of poor black and oppressed people. As you know, 10 years ago, he tried very hard to place some of our most persistent community leaders in jail. He failed because of an outcry from people all over this country, and that's what it takes.
That's when he was the U.S. attorney.
For Alabama, yes.
Do you feel that it's a conflict of interest for him to be trying to find out who burned the churches and at the same time investigating some of those same people for voter fraud?
Well, I don't think he's trying to find out who burnt the churches. I mean, I don't know what lip service he's given to that. I think that he intentionally sought this position to do at the state level what he failed to do at the federal level. I think his history is to target black leaders in the Black Belt, primarily in the Black Belt, because the Black Belt is the citadel of black progress. This is where we have majority black commissioners, majority black school boards. This is where we have black mayors. This is where we have made some political progress. So this is the place to target. Just as 100 years ago, it was the place to target with the violence. It's the place to target now with political oppression. So that has been his history. The voting persecution cases, I think it's been around 10 years ago. Again, he targeted every county in the Black Belt, top leaders. When I say top leaders, I'm talking about in terms of their civil rights history. He targeted them and indicted. He is now in a position to politically persecute people in the Black Belt. To give a full history would just take so much time. But when he, of course, tried to become a member of the 11th Circuit federal judge, and we were able to stop him with the help of the Legal Defense Fund. But the voters put him into this office because the voters recognize that they have a person that can maintain the white racist status quo in the South.
And that is Rose Sanders of the Voting Rights Museum in Selma, Alabama, interviewed by Ron Nixon of Southern Exposure Magazine and Dennis Bernstein. Dennis, it doesn't sound like Rose Sanders has much faith into this investigation.
She doesn't, and it's very interesting, Amy. She mentions the Legal Defense Fund and that them preventing Mr. Sessions from becoming a federal judge. One of the people who was a part of that defense fund was once again Deval Patrick, now the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. I think he should know, and probably does know, that he could have 200 agents, as he says, 400 agents, 600 agents. If these are the same kind of old boy agents that he was aware was supporting Mr. Sessions at the time, doing his phony investigations of black voter fraud, you can understand how he might be in a strange position and why people in Alabama and throughout the South don't feel like something is going to happen. Amy, we hear a lot about, Northerners might be surprised to know that there are still, say, in South Carolina, monuments celebrating the hanging of black people that show ropes going around black people's necks and shops that sell Klan paraphernalia. But those are just monuments. You have to understand that many of the same law enforcement officials are in power, are doing the investigation. So it's not surprising when we go through Alabama, we see this investigation into the churches turning into an investigation of black voter fraud. And by the way, on the way out, what happened with the churches? We have reports of people who are being questioned, being asked who they voted for, which, if that occurred, is a major civil rights violation. So there
Dennis,
are some severe problems.
Dennis, this is a very interesting point, that at the same time they're investigating the church, they're saying they're investigating the church attacks, that the FBI agents are going around and asking about voter fraud, which the black leaders are saying is scaring off anyone from saying anything.
Well, indeed. And they're saying, as they said in Tennessee and South Carolina, they're saying in Alabama, that everybody is a suspect, even though they keep arresting white people. They keep questioning black teenagers and trying to make it suggest that it's a black on black situation. The idea that Jeffrey Sessions, who's running for Senate, is attempting to do voter rights investigation at the very same time that he's running for Senate, trying to intimidate the people who would oppose him, who opposed him as a federal judge, is almost incomprehensible.
Dennis,
but that's exactly what's going on.
Thanks for joining us, Dennis Bernstein from Pacifica Radio and KPFA. That's it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Julie Drizin, our engineers Matthew Finch, director Errol Maitland. Thanks to Grayson Challenger and Paul Wunder. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Thanks for listening.